Bring the hoodie, footie, snuggle suit. Delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting the Moscow State Radio Symphony Orchestra on February 25th. More information on this and other events can be found at krannertcenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Illini Union Hotel. Located at the heart of campus, the Illini Union Hotel offers 72 newly remodeled guest rooms and two VIP suites with views of the main quad. More information is available at 333-1241 or on the web at union.illinois.edu.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Robert and Alice Campbell. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We were going to talk today with journalist David Finkel. He is a reporter with The Washington Post. We were going to talk with him about the surge in Iraq and the soldiers who served in the surge. David Finkel is the author of The Good Soldiers. Well, the weather in D.C. is pretty rough today. The area is being buffeted by fierce winds. And while our guest is at home and comfortable, he's not sure about power and phone service. So what we've done is we're going to reschedule this program. In fact, we have rescheduled it for February 17th. That's next Wednesday, 1 week from today. So in the meantime, we're going to go to the archives and we're going to rebroadcast an interview that we did last fall, with Deborah Tannen, author of You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. As this is a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. Thanks. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2. You'll find us online at WILL.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Linguist Deborah Tannen is interested in understanding and explaining the language of conversation, how we talk with one another. One of her most recent projects explored conversation between sisters. This afternoon, we'll talk with Tannen, who has two sisters, about what she learned. It's the subject of her new book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. Tannen writes that sisters share in conversation what we share in all relationships, only more so. Deborah Tannen teaches linguistics at Georgetown University, where she is university professor in the school's College of Arts and Sciences. She is the author of several best-selling books and many scholarly books and articles. She's also published poems, short stories, personal essays, and plays. Her previous books include You're Wearing That, Understanding Mothers and Daughters in Conversation, and I Only Say This Because I Love You, Talking to Your Parents, Partner, Sibs, and Kids When You're All Adults. Deborah Tannen's new book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives, is published by Random House. Deborah Tannen, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good.
Well, in the course of doing this project, did you interview any sister, any woman with a sister or sisters who was blasé about the relationship?
Yes. I encountered every point on a continuum you can imagine, from sisters who talked to each other five times a day, adored each other, and had just about nothing negative to say, to sisters who had cut one another off because they had so much negative feeling, as well as some who said that they really didn't have that much to do with their biological sisters, but felt that they had created sisters in friends. And most people fell somewhere in between.
Yeah. I would imagine that there wouldn't be too many sisters who were close in age, who grew up together, who wouldn't feel either, like you say at the outset of the book, I don't want anyone to kill my sister because I want to have the privilege of doing that myself, or I love her to death.
Yes, I think of an example that captures both. I was talking to a woman who was telling me she and her sister loved each other so much. When they talk on the phone and they run out of things to say, they just don't want to hang up. So they leave the phone line open, put the receiver down, and she said, it's just nice to know she's there. It's comforting, like hugging a cat. I thought that was so lovely. I immediately in my head figured out I'm going to use that example. Well, the next time I saw her, I said, how's your sister? She said, I don't know. I'm not talking to her.
Well, that's hugging a cat for you.
Exactly. If you hug a cat and it's not in the mood to be hugged, you can get scratched.
Yeah. Well, as an example of the powerful dynamic between sisters, maybe you would tell the story of Laxmi, a woman you met at a party who told you about the bond she had with her sister.
Yes, and it's similar in a way. She was from India, and when we were standing at the party and a number of other women too, we all gathered around talking about sisters, and she said how much she adored her sister. She said, I'm her lifeline. She's my lifeline. My husband says, I don't even want to ride in the car with you two because you never stop laughing and hugging each other. And I thought this was so wonderful. I wanted to know more, and I arranged to interview her one-on-one. And when we sat down, the first thing she said was she had just gone through an entire year of not talking to her sister. And it turned out to be about a topic that is often a point of contention, inheritance. So their parents, when they died, had left a building with two separate flats. Each sister owned one. And Laxmi had wanted to sell hers, but she realized that if she sold hers separately, the value of her sister's would go way down. So she asked her sister, why don't they both sell? Her sister said she really wasn't ready to sell. So she just kind of tabled the idea and left India to spend a significant amount of time with a daughter who lived abroad. Well, when she came back, she discovered not only had her sister changed her mind about selling her apartment, she had gone ahead and sold it. And now it was Laxmi's apartment which had plummeted in value. And she felt so hurt that her sister would do that, but even more, she felt angry on behalf of her own children, whose inheritance would also be affected.
Yeah. Who was the older sister in that situation?
She actually was the younger one.
Who sold the...
No, the one who had sold the apartment was the older one.
The older one.
Yeah. But she had so many stories about how close they were, how they had both gone to the same boarding school. They would just whisper and whisper and whisper all night. And when they, again, similar to the telephone story, when we ran out of things to say, she said, we would just look into each other's eyes. And I think the idea that your sister owns, is a part owner in things that are so precious to you, is symbolic of the relationship in a way. It's almost like she is part of you and owns part of you, and anything that she does will affect you, sometimes in a positive, but sometimes in a negative way.
How do sisters who have suffered a break then return to one another manage to make it happen?
As with almost everything, there are different ways to accomplish the same thing. Some sisters feel they can only get back together when they talk over what happened, air all their grievances, maybe exchange apologies, and then move on. Others feel just let bygones be bygones and just pick it up as if nothing happened. And either one can work, and I encountered examples where either one worked. The real problem is when one thinks you have to talk about it and work it out, and the other one would only want to get together if they could simply start all over.
Mm. Talking is pretty complex, as you well know. You note that a fine conversation can turn into an argument. And here, if we've got a situation where we're trying to talk things out, it can be really tough.
Yeah, and of course, that's one of the things about any close relationship. You think you're having a fine conversation, and then somebody says something, and all of a sudden you're having a fight. And typically, each one thinks the other one is the one who introduced the note of contention. But yeah, I mean, the truth is, if you talk about something that angered you, you can stir up all the animosity. I guess almost every book I write, I try to respect different styles of doing the same thing, because we have different styles of doing the same thing. So I think it's important for each one to realize that the other's perspective has validity. Mm. And it isn't only with conflicts. I talked to women who said, quote, "I wish my sister were more honest," by which she meant, "I wish she would talk about her feelings." But then I also heard women who told me their sisters had said, "Never ask me again how I feel." And it's, again, different ways to be close. For some people, it's just doing things together, laughing together. Often it's feeling she'll be there when I need her.
Yeah.
And then sometimes for other people, it's she's the one I can tell anything to. I can call her in the middle of the night when I can't sleep. Mm. But that won't be the case for all. I mean, for others, it might be I'll never tell her because she'll just say to me, "If you don't want to do anything about it, stop talking about it."
Mm. Speaking of different styles, one of the stories in the book that I thought was a good one, two sisters, Noreen and Janet. Noreen wants to borrow a gown from Janet, but she didn't ask. She didn't think she needed to. Another story follows about Mara and Loretta and who will take their mom to a doctor appointment. Maybe you'd tell us these stories, but back to Noreen and Janet specifically.
Yes. I love that story because it's so revealing of conversational style.
Mm-hmm.
So one sister said to the other, "Oh, you must have noticed I've been angry at you." Well, in fact, she hadn't. And that's an example right there of one who would have always said it if she was angry, and the other who expects it to be perceived. Well, it turned out that the one sister had, she had a lot of gowns. She just had the kind of life where she often went to galas, and she'd been actually commenting to her sister, "Oh, you know, I have all these gowns. I'll probably never wear most of them again." Her sister didn't have need for that, but then suddenly she did have one occasion she had to attend where she needed a gown. Well, she assumed that her sister would offer it. And when the one who had the gown said, "But you never asked." "Mm-hmm. You know, of course I would have given you one if you'd asked." And she said, "Well, I was waiting for you to bring it up." Well, what's funny is when you tell this story, most people think they absolutely know which sister is right. So the one who told me the story was the one who had the gowns, and I could tell she had told this story many times before, and her friends had clearly reinforced her view, and she expected I would as well. "What's the matter with your sister? She should ask you. Otherwise, it's not fair." She felt like she had failed a test she didn't even know she was taking.
Mm.
And I pointed out, it's a lot, comes down, for one thing, to style, but also message and meta-message, the M-E-T-A, meta-message. So the gown, you might say, is the message, will she or will she not have this gown to borrow? But the meta-message is, does your sister care enough that she will offer you the gown? And if you have a style that expects people to offer, then if she doesn't offer, if you ask for the gown, you would still feel hurt. Because it's like she put you in a position she should not have put you in, making you ask for it.
Yeah.
And then some people just think that's self-evident. Of course you should offer it. And I'll tell you, it's interesting, the woman from the hugging a cat example, after a year, she and her sister were talking again. She called me to tell me that, and I was so pleased that I got it in the book. I was able to end on a happier note. She said she had just commented to her sister, she was going to make a trip down south, and she really didn't have the appropriate clothes. And her sister, without saying, you know, anything, she was going to do it, she brought over a pile of freshly washed and ironed and folded appropriate clothes that she was going to lend her for the trip.
Wow. Very nice.
Yeah. So I think both styles make sense. You run into trouble when one thinks one is obviously the right way to communicate, and the other has a very different idea. I'm sorry, you asked about the other example, the doctor?
Yeah, we also do have a caller waiting to talk with us, so let's go and take a call, and then we can come back to the Mara and Loretta story.
Uh-huh.
Okay, this caller is waiting for us in Piatt County on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I wanted to I'm listening on several levels here because of my relationship with my own sister and the complexities there. But I'm also, my students at Parkland are this week discussing Deborah Tannen's article on marked women and unmarked men.
Oh, great.
And I'm so excited to be able to tell them tomorrow that I spoke with you, but what's disturbing to me about, I wanted to talk about the article just very briefly to say that the girls in the class seem completely, in general, accepting of the fact that they're marked, but the young men in the class are very vocal about the fact that they, too, are very marked by the young women. And so I just, we've been discussing this, so I just wanted to ask your opinion so I can go back to them tomorrow. And
okay, I'll have to briefly explain what I mean when I say women are marked and
okay.
They're unmarked. It does trace to a linguistic concept where words can have a neutral meaning
mm-hmm.
or they can be marked for something. So the unmarked form of a verb is present tense, mm-hmm. but if you want it to be future, you mark it by adding will. If you want it to be past, you mark it by adding ed,
mm-hmm.
or a mutual word of a word would be singular. If you want to make it plural, you have to mark it. You could add an s or an en. So that's just quickly what it means about marked. And the point I make in that essay is that women have to choose between such a great range of hairstyles and clothing styles that there really is nothing, no choice we can make that's neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why, by the way, the book about mothers and daughters was called You're Wearing That, because so often we have different ideas about what's appropriate and are critical of people we're close to. Women judge each other about this all the time, but we usually don't say anything. If you feel close to a person, maybe this does come up with sisters as well, you say something. So it's when men say they are marked also, there's obviously truth to that. They could wear something that would cause them to be interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
But they do have the option to be neutral, and that's what women don't have.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, whenever I give the talk about mothers and daughters, I would look around the audience and say, look at the range of hairstyles among women in the room. Now look at the range of hairstyles among men in the room. Now, there might be some men who have a hairstyle that's marked, if they have a ponytail, or they might have a beard, or they might have hair that's so long that it would attract attention. But most of the men have a hairstyle you really wouldn't notice. You wouldn't say, oh, I can tell by his hair that's the kind of person he is. But every hairstyle that a woman had would lead people to interpret the kind of person she is. And so many of the choices women have to make are about, are we sexy enough or are we too sexy? That's a kind of unspoken criterion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you wear a dress. You've got to figure out how long or short it's supposed to be. And we often look at another woman. Her hair could be longer, shorter, curlier, straighter, off her face, pushed back, pulled down. So the point, and I understand it's very hard for guys sometimes to really get inside what that is all about because they're very aware of how they are judged by choices they make, but the real point is that they can make a choice that will not attract attention and will not lead people to say, I know what kind of person he is, because, whereas with women, any choice we make will be interpreted. That's a long answer, but I hope it answers.
I am so grateful, and my students will be probably not as interested as I am.
It is interesting, yeah, that particular essay it's almost like a cult favorite among women in high positions at work.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, because it is so challenging for women in managerial positions to find that right balance.
Well, I think for those of us who have been at conferences and then having then read your article, it just really wakes you up to all kinds of things. And so thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll report back to my students. Thanks again.
And we hope you'll keep listening now for the sister angle of things here on the program. Let's take one more call. Someone's waiting for us in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I just was going to comment on the last argument, you know, the two sisters about the gown.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, she already gave her permission. She had this discussion and said, you know, I got these gowns. If you need one, I got them. So I don't understand how there would be, you know, you should have asked when she already told her that there was like a blanket. Go ahead.
Well, she actually didn't say if you need it, you can have one, because
why did she bring up all the gowns?
At the time she was talking about her own gowns, the assumption was that the other sister never needed it because her life was such that she really never did. So
she was just talking about all these fabulous gowns she has?
I'm sorry?
So she was just talking about all the fabulous gowns she has?
Oh, you know, it just came up in conversation. I you know, I wasn't there, so I can't be sure how it came up, but
to me, when you do that, you're not, you like to, unless you're like grandiosing yourself, you would say, oh man, I've got all these jeans, you know, need a pair, I got it, you know.
Well, I don't think that sister felt that way about it, but
yeah.
what I'm so impressed by in your comment, which I always am, is that because we have one style or another, it seems completely self-evident that to say it would mean a certain thing, whereas it can be just as self-evident to somebody with a different style that obviously you would interpret it differently. But the I see what you're saying, that it would sound boastful, but I don't think that was part of the story.
Okay. Because to me that just made sense. We, like, I have four sisters, and I would never just talk about all these great things I have.
I may not have told the story quite right.
Okay.
I don't think it was like she said, oh, my God, what am I going to do with all these gowns? You know, that certainly would sound like most of
it. I probably would still ask.
It was their lives were very different, and it was not really relevant to the other at that point.
Okay, well, I just wanted to comment on that one.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Deborah Tannen, author most recently of You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, now let's go back to that story about Mara and Loretta. That's another good story.
This is about two sisters whose mother was aging and needed a fair amount of care. And by the way, I'll interrupt myself here. Since I went into that long explanation about the other point about marked women, that does come from a book called Talking from 9 to 5, which is about women and men at work.
Okay,
so this was a story about two sisters, one older, one younger, whose mother lived in the same town, and the older sister was the one who was doing all the lion's share of the work and taking care of the mother. Now, sometimes that happens because one lives in the same town and the other doesn't. But in this case, they both did live in that town. But the older one was the one who always got the responsibility, check on mother, make sure she's got food in the refrigerator, that spoiled food has been thrown out, doctor appointments, taking her on any errands she needed to go on. And the older one was very resentful that she was doing all the work. So at one point, she asked the younger one, you know, Mom's got this doctor's appointment on such and such a day. Would you be able to take her? It seemed like that's like the least she could do. And the young one said, I really can't. I've got commitments that day. And it was told to me in the spirit of, you see, no matter what thing I ask her, she won't do it. How come I always can make time and she can't? Well, looking at it again from message and meta message, to be told, this is the day of the appointment, can you cancel whatever you have and do it, would feel like she's being given instructions from an authority figure. I suggested that perhaps if they sat down and said, okay, let's make a list of all the tasks that need to be done, and let's see if we can split them up. You know, you tell me which ones you feel you can do, I'll say which ones I feel I can do. If doctor visits is one that the younger sister chose, then she should make the appointment, which means she's the one who decides the time, and if she has to pick a time when it would conflict with another commitment, she probably would be quite willing to cancel it because it would be her own authority at that point.
Mm.
So it's the meta message of being assigned a task.
Yeah, it sounds like asking, but it's telling.
Well, so much of what I encountered was inseparable from your place in the lineup by age. I frequently heard oldest sisters accused of being bossy and judgmental, And I frequently heard youngest sisters accused of not doing their share. And that was an example of that. And I always try to see where did these things come from. So if you go back to their childhood, I think often older ones, it's really an unjust position. It may be the position in the family with the greatest injustice, because the oldest often is expected to tell the younger ones what to do and to be protective. And so she kind of, maybe it becomes habit forming. and part of being protective is you try to tell the other ones how they should improve, so, which of course is helpful, but can also be criticism, is also criticism. And I think from the point of view of younger ones, often they don't get in the habit of pitching in because maybe there was no room for them because somebody else was always doing it. And maybe whenever they did do something, they were told to do it a different way. And that's what they want to avoid.
Mm. Well, maybe now you'd tell us the story about you and Mimi and the cabbage.
I love that story. Okay, so we're in the kitchen in my oldest sister's home, which is in the country, and it was a family reunion. So we were preparing lunch for a large number of people, and just the three sisters were doing this in the kitchen. So Naomi, the oldest, was making hamburgers, and Mimi, the middle one, was cutting cabbage for coleslaw, and I, as per my usual, was the eager assistant. Is there anything I can do? Well, yeah, I get that bowl. Right? Yeah, I get the bowl. Anything else I can do? Yeah, why don't you slice these tomatoes? Okay. As I washed them, I sliced the tomatoes, and I don't think I thought much about it. I was participating. My middle sister, Mimi's husband, came in and asked if she wanted to go with him on a walk. And she kept cutting the cabbage and said, well, I have to cut this cabbage. And she never stopped cutting the cabbage, and he didn't go away. He was sitting there, kind of standing there looking expectant. And I was the observer, as I often am. And I'm thinking, yeah, he's not going away because he really wants her company. She really wants to go, but she feels she shouldn't because she has this obligation. And then all of a sudden I thought, wait a minute. And I said, Mim, why don't you go for a walk with Bruce, and then I'll cut the cabbage. She dropped that knife so fast, I think she was out the door before my sentence was done. And I asked her later why it had it occurred to her that I could have done it. And she said no. And I realized at that moment that, in a way, I have two oldest sisters because one is 8 years older and the other is 2 years older. With 6 years between Mimi and Naomi, Mimi is really like another oldest. So both my sisters are inclined. If there's something to do, they just feel you have to do it. And they don't stop to think, is it possible one of these younger ones could do it instead? I don't think cutting the cabbage gave her any special pleasure, but it did give me. I mean, I loved the fact that I was doing a main task. I had seen a need and stepped in instead of just being, you know, fetching the bowl or washing the tomato.
Yeah, I think that often happens with women who are, I don't know, who are solid with one another. They just do what needs to get done, and they're not looking to, you know, cause any problems or say you're not doing your share or anything. It's just let's.
It gets so complicated because, you know, older ones can see younger ones as not doing their share.
Yeah.
And I did check that out with my sisters, you know, and they said, no, I always do offer to help. But offer to help is different from you just see the need and you step in.
Right.
But I think younger ones sometimes resent the older ones for just see a need and step in. I have a story about when I was about 17 and traveling with my sister Naomi, and she was doing everything, and I was actually mad at her. I wanted her to step back and let me do something. Mm. And at that time, of course, you know, you're a teenager and you're easily angered. I thought she was dissing me almost. But in retrospect, I don't think it crossed her mind that anyone else could do it. You know, something needed to be done, she did it.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Well, in your conversations, like about that, I tend to blame the mother because you're talking about how the older sisters generally did it. You know, were asked to do. I come from a school. My thought on it is that parents should be doing it, not having the older kids take care of the younger kids. And I see this too much in society. So when the older one perhaps was
always doing things and then felt the need to criticize the younger one and the way they do them, that story. I don't hear any discussion about where the mother's input was at that time. Where was the mom?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point. In many of the cases I encountered, there were structural reasons why mothers couldn't do everything. Sometimes both parents worked. Sometimes there was no father and the mother worked full time. Sometimes the mother had physical or psychological disabilities that prevented her from doing it herself.
You mean, so, they were growing
up? Yeah, in some cases it was like that. And I did definitely encounter examples where the mother was home and did not give the older any responsibility at all. But in most of the cases that I encountered, even if it wasn't the extreme cases where an oldest really had to be like a mother because the mother couldn't take that role, there were still many instances where the two younger ones, the kids were together and parents weren't there. And older ones do have a way of pushing the younger ones around. I have lots of examples of that. One that I love, a woman told me, a younger sister, she and her sister used to play a game called Mop. She was the mop.
Oh.
Her sister would pull her around by her feet and her hair spread out. Now, I check all examples with the people I get them from, so I sent her what I had written, and she said, yeah, you got it right, but you're making it sound like my sister was mean to me. She said, I loved playing mop. So, yeah. But it's, there are so many, many examples where, and just because of the difference in abilities, the older one was protective or just kind of pushing the younger one around. One last personal example, my father overheard me asking my sister Mimi, I must have been about four, Mimi, can I play in your backyard?
Mm.
I don't think my parents gave me the idea it was her backyard.
Yeah. I just see that too much, like in the community. I'm like, why is your 10-year-old watching your 2-year-old? You know, just shouldn't be happening. So, you know what I mean? So I always say, you know, it's my kids. I'll take care of it. You know, you're one of them that I had. And I think that's an issue that needs to be addressed in society,
yeah,
but not just as sisters because we're caregivers. But
yeah, I think if you can, that is obviously a wonderful, wonderful thing. And again, sometimes it's just necessity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thank
Thanks
you.
For the call. I suppose, too, it could be family style.
Family style?
Yeah. We all, you know, by choice or a matter of necessity, it's...
Well, again, you know, I think there's some of it is just the caller clearly has a very... it's fortunate that she can do all that herself, and sometimes it's just necessity in situations like those I described. But there really is a sense in which an older one just has more ability and is protective of a younger one. And I was observed this, just short example. I could give so many where there was a family, two parents, two kids, little ones. Maybe one was 3 or 4 and one was maybe 5 or 6. And they were standing on a train platform. And the little one just sort of was wandering, and the older one grabbed her and was in an held her in an embrace that kept her away from the edge. Now, I'm sure the mother would have done it if the sister hadn't done it first, she was there. But it was just a very touching protective impulse. Maybe this is a good time to give the example that I'm so fond of, the Delaney sisters.
Okay.
There was a book about them some years back, and Bessie Delaney was quoted as saying about her sister Sadie, Sadie doesn't approve of me sometimes. She looks at me in that big sister sort of way. Well, when she said that, Bessie Delaney was 101, but her sister was 103. And then elsewhere, Sadie is quoted as saying, the only reason I'm alive is to keep her alive. If she lives to 130, I'll just have to live to 132 so I can take care of her.
Mm.
So I think it says something just about these built-in dynamics.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, linguist Debra Tannen. We're talking with her about sisters this afternoon. It's the topic of the subject of her latest book, You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. 1-800-273-8255. How do sisters talk about their similarities and their differences?
Yeah, I was struck that almost all the women, especially American women I spoke to, would start by telling me that they and the sisters are different. And sometimes it would be, we never got along, we're very different. Or it might be, we're really close, even though we're very different. And it made me realize how much our sense of who we are is inseparable from who we are in relation to her. So a woman who was 5'3", for example, told me she always felt like a hulking giant because her sisters are 5'1". Now, it wasn't until I told that example when my middle sister Mimi was in the audience that she said, did you tell that because you know that I always thought I was short? Now, Mimi was almost 5'6". I said, no, I didn't even know that. Well, I was 5'9". So it's a very parallel thing. I mean, you're 5'3", you think you're a giant. You're 5'6", you think you're short. It's how, who you are in relation to your sister. And this one woman who told me she was graduated number 10 in her high school class of 200. But still, she always thought she wasn't smart because her sister graduated number 2. It, and in some ways, it's the labels, maybe an extreme word, but kind of labels that families sometimes apply where we just get the sense, this is the shy one, this is the outgoing one, this is the musician, this is the athlete, and maybe most unfortunate, the smart one and the pretty one. And in two cases that I encountered, the smart one and the pretty one were identical twins.
Interesting.
Yeah, so it really says something about how when you're in the same family, and probably even more so if you're close in age, there is a tendency to define each in terms of the other and make those distinctions.
Hmm. Did sisters ask you for your advice in strengthening their bond and being better in their conversations with one another?
I do get a lot of questions like that now. The women I interviewed, not so much. But I did come up with some patterns that I noticed in sisters who did seem very close. One is that they often traveled together or took time out, just the sisters, without spouses, without kids. And I heard so many stories about how funny it was, how they would laugh. You could be silly like when you were kids. I think also remembering to say the positive. It is so meaningful to feel that your sister is proud of you or admires you. And this, that's the kind of thing we often don't think to say. Yeah, we often end phone conversations with, love you. But this would be more specific. I'm so impressed with the way you handle your job, or you've done such a great job raising your kids. This specific thing. And the kid, raising kids is one that if you feel criticized, it's especially bad. So feeling praised, I think, is especially good. And humor can be great. There were topics that I would hear about in one family that it was a big secret, and then I would hear the same thing laughed about in another family, and then it wouldn't be a problem just because you could tease about it.
Mm.
So those are just a few.
Did you look at sister communication in terms of all the different ways we can communicate now outside of the open phone line, for example, email, texting, Twitter, and the like?
I did. I do have quite a bit on that. And like all new media, it can amplify good or bad depending on how and when it's used. So the availability of email and cell phones and texting certainly creates more opportunities to keep in touch. You might not have time to take a half hour out of your life to make a phone call, but if you've got email at work or you can just pick up the cell phone when you're commuting, it's an opportunity to keep in touch. The thing that I would be cautious about, email is not a good medium to work out difficulties. When I heard examples of real distress over really big conflicts, often I sent her an email, was in there somewhere, and more than once I heard, I sent her a very conciliatory email and I got this belligerent response. Well, I would then ask to see it. And in the cases where I did get to see it, I could see why they got a belligerent response. Email is very tricky because, first of all, you can get carried away convincing yourself of how right you are. And you're so happy you've sent it, you've laid out all your perspective. But the other person could be put off early on, and then you just keep getting worse, you know, digging yourself in deeper and deeper. It doesn't have the tone of voice. It doesn't have the facial expression. And you can't make up for any negative response you might be having on the spot. So I think it can be harder to just pick up the phone or even meet and talk about it. But if something is a problem and you want to work it out, that is preferable.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana next. Line one. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for your books and for your comments about older siblings taking over because they have the ability to do things or see the need in a situation. And I was wondering if you could comment on times or ways you've seen big sisters being able to shift in that role and become one of the siblings as an adult as opposed to always being the big sister.
Yes, that's such a great question. I'm thinking of one oldest of five who had been given responsibility because her mother really just couldn't handle it. And she told me that she realized all her younger sisters and brothers were always calling her with their problems and acting as if she didn't have any, and she was feeling resentful. Then she realized she never told them her problems. No wonder they thought she didn't have any. So she made a conscious decision that she would begin telling them about her problems just as she would her friends, which she normally wouldn't have done with her younger siblings. And she said it felt very uncomfortable in the beginning, but then she started to get comfortable with it, and it started to feel natural. And, yes, that made her more of an equal with them. I think also, just as this was advice that I gave and that people just came away with from my book about mothers and daughters, is often applies to older sisters as well, that sometimes you just have to bite your tongue when you see ways that the others could do things better. You love them. You want the best for them. It's really tempting to just tell them so you can help them out. But it's going to come across as criticism because it is. You know, if you were not doing something wrong, you wouldn't need advice, suggestions, or help in any way. So just biting your tongue can also take away some of that older, younger, parent-like stance that can develop.
Yes, I've been careful to pay attention to when I'm not taking them seriously just because they're younger.
I can see that. You know, a woman, I have to say, my chapter on older sisters is the longest. And I just developed so much compassion for older sisters. It's a role I didn't understand in a gut way since that wasn't the role I had. But one older sister I talked to said she didn't even realize how much attention her younger siblings paid to everything she said. She said, "I don't want them to pay that much attention. I don't feel..." But they do. And
my sister-in-law recently said to me, Joe, her husband, my brother, said, she'd say, "Well, where did you learn how to do this? And where did you learn how to do that?" And he said, "Well, taught me how to do all that, you know, taught him how to make pastry and all kinds of other things." And he recently told me that, you know, when he thinks of his mother, there's a lot of me in there as well as our mother. And it's what's been given me this awareness after our mother passed away that one of my siblings wrote me a note and said, "You'll always be my big sister." And my reply was, "I'd just like to be a sister, not the big, with a capital big sister."
Yeah, it could be, one woman said, it's a kind of a sibling noblesse oblige. She said she didn't ask for it. But yeah, I mean, it can be, and I think it's particular to American culture that we would rather get around that and feel like we're all equals when we're adults. When I talk to women from more traditional cultures, they took for granted that the role in the lineup by age was going to determine how you relate your whole lives. And they see in that a kind of connection. So I think, you know, part of it can just be appreciate it and accept it, and part of it can be if there are parts that you're not comfortable with, you can try to reframe.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. So if your family was from India, you would have addressed Naomi as big sister.
That's right. late, India, Japan, China, Philippines, many cultures of the world, a younger sibling does not address an older one by name.
Yeah, and you would have been called Deborah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Or the little one.
Little one. One last question here. What can those of us on the outside of sisterhood learn about our relationships with others from sisters?
Yeah, people who don't have sisters are telling me they find it interesting from the point of view of friends would be one thing. They see similar patterns with their friends. It helps them understand those in their life who are sisters or have sisters. So men tell me it really helps them understand their wives' relationship with sisters, which otherwise were mystifying to them. And I think it really is about the working out of dynamics that are true in all close relationships, finding that right balance between how close or distant you want to be and how you're going to juggle relative power. And that's really what the sister relationships are all about as well.
Yeah, and certainly the information about meta messages is good for us all.
Yes, to just realize that everything we say has those two levels. And so often when people say, well, I said this, I don't know why she reacted that way, rather you might want to say, well, what is it about what I said that led her to react that way? And could I speak it in a different way and get a different reaction?
Well, in all the interviews and conversations with sisters, what did you find the most fascinating?
I think that interplay between power and closeness, the tremendous longing for closeness, but also the how you kept tripping up with competition and comparison.
And comparison.
Yeah, and the power of comparison.
Oh. There we have to leave it. Deborah, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Deborah Tannen is the author most recently of You Were Always Mom's Favorite, Sisters in Conversation Throughout Their Lives. The publisher is Random House. And that interview was conducted on October 27th of last year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Standing by now with settlement prices from Chicago and Kansas City, Todd Gleason.
Thank you so much, Celeste. The numbers in Chicago finished up the afternoon like this for the day. They finished with the nearby March wheat at 496 and three quarters, up 14 and three quarters on the afternoon. 503 the top, the bottom at 480 and three quarters. Settlement price at 496 and three quarters, up 14 and a half. May 517 and a half, the high, the low at 495 and a half. Settlement price at 511 and three quarters, up 14 and a half in July. 529 and a half, the high, the low at $5.08. Settlement price in the soft red at 524 and a quarter for the July harvest month, up 14 and a quarter. September contract at 540, settlement price with a top of 44 and a bottom of 26 and a quarter. Again, the September settled at $5.40 a bushel, up 13 and three quarters. Hard red winter wheat traded in Kansas City at the Board of Trade there. March contract of 514 and a quarter top, bottom at 489 and a half, settlement price at 505 and three quarters. March 2010 wheat at 15 and three quarters, higher on the afternoon in Kansas City. Back in Chicago, corn pit now, 365 and a half the high. The low there at $3.55 and a quarter, settlement price 361 and three quarters, up three and a quarter. The May at 376 and three quarters top, bottom at 66 and three quarters, settlement price at $3.73 and a quarter, up three. And July, 387 the high, the low at 377 and a half. July corn settled $3.83 and three quarters, up 3 cents. September contract 393 and a quarter the high, the low at 384 and a quarter. Settlement price at 390 and a quarter, up three. In December futures, the harvest month 399 and a half the high. The low at 390, settlement price at $3.96. December corn settled 2.5 higher. March contract at 410 and a quarter top, bottom at 401 and a quarter. Settlement price at $4.06 and three quarters, up 2 cents. March oat futures 232 and a quarter, up 2 1/4. The May up 2 1/4 as well. Settlement price at 240 and three quarters. Soy complex nearby March beans 939 and three quarters the high. The low at 918 and three quarters. Settlement price at 937 and a half, up 13. May futures 948 and three quarters the high, the low at 28 and three quarters, settlement price at 947, up 11 and three quarters. And the July contract 955 and a half the high, the low at 37 and a quarter, Settlement price at $9.54.5, up 10.5. August futures, $9.50.25, the high, the low at 34.25. Settlement price at $9.50, up 8.5 cents. September, $9.33, the high, the low at $9.19. Settlement price for the September beans at $9.31.5, up 5.75. Now the November contract, 3 cents the gain. 9.18 the top, the bottom at 9.04.25. Settlement price at $9.15.5 a bushel. November 2010 contract for the soybeans up 3 cents. March bean meal futures 276.50 the high, the low at 255.60. Settlement price at $276.40 a ton, up $5.80. The May futures at 269.80, up 5.60. March soybean oil 38.52 the high, the low at 37.92. Settlement price at 38.27. Down 11 cents. During the closing market report this afternoon, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services. Two quick reminders. Please do visit our website at willag.org. You will find a calendar of events there. It does or did list an event this evening in New Ross, Indiana, an Outlook meeting. Dave Dickey will not be making his way over there. That one's been canceled and scheduled again for the 24th of February. Again, the Outlook meeting for New Ross, Indiana, is canceled this evening because of the bad weather conditions and will be rescheduled to the 24th day of February. I'll be back in just about 9 minutes with the closing market report. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Mike Morris in McHenry at 815-344-7213. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
The livestock contracts finished higher again today in Chicago. February live cattle, 88.87.5 the high, 88.25 the low, 88.82.5 the settlement, up 7.5. April, 91.70 the high, 90.90 the low, the settlement, 91.55, up 7.5. June, 89.20 the high, 88.55 the low, 89.12.5 the settlement, up 22.5. And August, 88.10 the high, 87.60 the low, the settlement, 88.10, up 20. March feeder cattle, $100.40 the high, 99.60 the low, the settlement, $100.25, that up 27.5. April, 101.25 the high, $100.35 the low, 101.15 the settlement, up 55. May, 102.32.5 the high, the low, 101.60, the settlement, 102.22.5. The settlement for May feeder cattle, that was up 37.5. August, 103.50 the high, 103 even the low, 103.47.5 the settlement, up 37.5. February lean hog, 67.95 the high, 67.60 the low, 67.90 the settlement, up 37.5. April, 68.50 the high, 67.70 the low, finishing at 68.17.5. That was up 32.5. May, the high today, 74.67.5, the low 74.10, 74.62.5, the settlement up 42.5. June, 77.40, the high 76.75, the low, the settlement 77.15, up 35. March bellies, 85 even, the high 83 even, the low, the settlement 84.50, that up 145. The Dow currently off 14 points. Had to make that 16 points latest tick at 10,042. The NASDAQ is off 2 at 2149. The S&P 500 off 2 at 1,069. Nearby crude up 64 at $74.39 a barrel. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu, will.illinois.edu. Let's take a look at the forecast for Illinois and Indiana. At least we'll get through the advisories. Winter storm warning remains in effect for much of northern and central into southern Indiana until 7 p.m. Eastern Time, east, central, and southeastern Indiana until 6